You're at the Coaching Inn, 3D Coaching's virtual pub, where we enjoy conversations with people who are engaged in the world of coaching.
Welcome to this week's edition of the Coaching Inn. I'm Claire Pedrick, and today it's my pleasure to have Michael Bungay-Stanier with me. Welcome, Michael.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Well, our listeners are super excited to have you here, as am I. Because I only recommend four books ever, and one of them is yours.
Ah, that's so good. What are the other three?
So we recommend Your Advice Trap.
Fantastic.
We recommend Listen by Catherine Mannix.
Nice. Catherine Mannix is brilliant. I've interviewed her on my podcast. I've had a glass of wine with Catherine Mannix. She was the first person who introduced the CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, into palliative care. Yeah. And her book, The End in Mind, is brilliant. So I love that you're recommending her stuff.
Well, I would love to live down the road from Catherine Mannix. My dad died, and Catherine's TED Talk was the best thing that supported him and me through that last thing. So she's amazing. Truly, Listen by Catherine Mannix. Improv Your Life by Pippa Evans.
Okay, I don't know that one, but I've done improv training, so I probably know some of the basics.
So Pippa Evans isn't a coach.
Right.
Well, neither is Catherine, although I kind of suggest that she is. And then I recommend mine.
Of course. That's great. That's a good list. Well, I'm flattered to be on it. Thank you.
However, this morning I've just received 5 copies of How to Listen by Oscar Trimboli.
Oh, I love Oscar, down in Melbourne in Australia, and I blurbed his book, I think, somewhere. Yeah.
You did. You blurbed the top of his book, so I'm looking forward to reading that, and that might make it to number 5.
He's very wise about the art of deep listening. You know, that's where he's hung his hat, and he's very good at it.
Yeah. So one of our listeners in Japan said, you must interview Oscar Trimboli. So I just contacted him, and he went, yes, which is what you said. So thank you very much for being here.
It's a pleasure.
So tell us a bit about the story that got you to recognizing how important conversations would be.
Well, I live in Canada, Toronto, but I grew up in Australia, and I grew up in a very lovely household, good parents and 2 brothers I mostly liked. But I wouldn't call us a particularly chatty family. Like, there's an inner joke about how Stanier men tend to be a bit taciturn, a bit quiet. On the other hand, I've always been a bit of a show off. You know, apparently as a 3-year-old, I come up to strangers in a supermarket and go, "Hi, I'm Michael. I can hop. Would you like to see me hop?" So I kind of liked the spotlight.
I love that.
And I remember being in a university class. So I was 18 or so, 19. And it was me and my friend Michael Bachelard, and 8 other women. It was an English literature class. And I noticed in a moment that he and I were doing a lot of the talking. And I'm not sure we were mansplaining exactly. That term didn't even exist back then. But we were certainly consuming more than our share of the oxygen. And in part because we're like excited and we like reading and we like literature and we kind of liked ideas. And it triggered something in me that the next step for me was actually going and training on a youth suicide hotline, something called Youthline in Australia. And that was the first training for me to understand the power of asking a question, the power of understanding that their first answer might not be their only answer. Their first answer might be at one level and there might be other stuff kind of going on underneath. Training based on Carl Rogers' work, so Rogerian counseling. And kind of that was it for me. You know, I did that for a number of years in Australia. And then, by the time I finally left, I went to England to study. By the time I finally left university, coaching was just becoming to become a thing. And I noticed that I was in England, so it was a weird Californian thing. So we're like, I don't know, these Californians, I'll do anything. But that first seed had really been planted with that youth crisis counselling telephone training.
That's so interesting, isn't it? Because I think we might be a reasonable similar ages. And of course, my first job was coaching, but I didn't know it was coaching because nobody called it coaching.
Right, right.
And then the Americans started talking about coaching.
I suspect we're of that generation where we're like, we remember a time when nobody was a coach other than the person blowing a whistle on the sports field. And now, of course, almost everybody's a coach.
Exactly. Although I did a podcast with Terry Belf, who in America, and she said that coaching started in Europe.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, I know Terry, well, I don't know her particularly well, but I know her from the very early days of coaching. So, there we go. Yeah. That's possible.
Yeah. So when did you first realize you were a coach?
Well, I don't call myself a coach now. I've always been, but I would have said that for a long time, I would call myself a facilitator or a teacher, you know, which are adjacent labels, I think, to coaching. If you had to pin me down now, I would call myself a teacher. Mm-hmm. And then as a kind of core belief in terms of what I bring to the world. And then there's different ways in which I do that. I speak, I facilitate, I don't have a coaching practice because I've discovered that my best work is done creating content and writing books and stuff rather than the one-to-one stuff. But I do a certain amount of kind of informal ad hoc coaching, I guess, because I'm just naturally a curious person and, you know, I do ask a lot of questions. But certainly there was a moment when I just, coaching became a thing and I did my first coach training, early 2001 with CTI. And being a coach felt like a helpful phase to go through, a useful confirmation that the way I showed up in the world was a useful way to show up.
Yeah. Yeah. And the thing I really like about your books, Michael, is that they are really simple and straightforward.
Thanks.
And that is very opposite to the industry of coaching.
Yeah. Well, it actually, part of the reason for writing the book was an irritation that there was a certain amount of kind of woo-woo abstraction, kind of jazz hands, kind of black box around coaching. And so certainly for the coaching habit and the advice trap, a key part of this was trying to unweird coaching for normal people so that it felt like it was a tool that anybody could use. You didn't have to be qualified as a coach to be more coach-like. I know these books have been helpful and successful in the world of coaching, but I really wrote them for people who weren't coaches, but who wanted to bring some of the power of coaching into their everyday life, whether that's as a manager and a leader or as a parent or as some other role.
Because it's just a conversation, isn't it?
Well, it's just a conversation is a pretty loaded term because it's like it's a conversation where it takes a certain amount of self-management and skill to make it work. But indeed, in the end, it's a great conversation.
Yeah. One of the things that I noticed that people really like about your books is that it helps them to see underneath and it helps them to see the least that they need to do to be able to have these great conversations.
Yeah, you know, my design philosophy, not just in my books, but in the programs I design and all the stuff I do, is what's the least I can teach that would be the most useful. So one of the ways we seek to reassure ourselves that we're adding value is by pumping more stuff in. So absolutely, this is true whether you're coaching or teaching or writing. You're like, I'll just add this extra bit. And, you know, at the heart of facilitation and coaching is creating space for the other person to be able to engage in what's there. Mm-hmm. And that often means you needing to step out of the spotlight, remove some of the content, make it about them rather than about you. And so often the reason content's there is a look at me and I'm adding value. Look at me and I've got a safety net. Look at me and this silence isn't awkward. So it's taken a while to figure this out, but I do a lot of work trying to strip content away so there's space for people to really get it. And also it makes me go, what is the most essential thing for me to talk about or to teach?
I absolutely agree with you, because that's also my philosophy, which was why it was such a delight to suddenly come across your work and think, oh, I'm not completely bonkers after all.
Well, you might be completely bonkers, but
maybe we both are.
Yeah, at least we agree on this design principle. Yeah.
Yeah, because complexity. In fact, I was talking to a coach in the States this morning, and she was saying that she'd found out about me. And she's also read your stuff, she was saying, telling me. Because she was looking around the world and going, surely it can't be this hard.
Mm. Yeah, some of my favorite moments are when people go through a 1-day program I've created, which we typically sell into big companies, and they're like, I think I just spent 9 months in a coach training school to learn what you've just taught in a day. And I'm like, coaching is simple but difficult.
Yeah.
You know, it's like just a conversation that's simple but difficult to have just a conversation. It's difficult to manage your own anxiety about the ambiguity and the silences and the uncertainty of what's going on. It's difficult to stay fully present to the other person. It's difficult to really see them in their full catastrophe, you know, the excellence and the messiness of who they are. It's difficult to not finish conversations with a neat bow and a ta-da. It's difficult to not avoid some of the more challenging things you might say to somebody. All of these things are they're simple enough in terms of technique, but they're difficult to do for all sorts of other reasons.
Yeah, you can see what you need to do, but doing it is the harder step, isn't it? Yeah. So you were on Gary Crotas's podcast the other day.
True. Yeah.
And he said to me, talk to Michael about Keystone Conversations.
Mm. So I have a new book out, or a relatively new book, called How to Work with Almost Anyone, which I think is probably the best book title I've ever come up with. It's like, it's just a good book title. I love it. And, you'd call it a sister book, I think, or a cousin book to The Advice Trap and The Coaching Habit. Because the primary people I wrote those two books for were busy managers and leaders. You know, that was my imagined avatar, if you like, as I wrote that. And, you know, in the context of work, although I think it goes broader than that, your happiness and your success so often depend on the quality of your working relationships. And this is true whether you're in a big company or whether you run your own coaching practice or whatever it might be. And most of the time we don't do much about that. We just hope for the best.
Mm-hmm.
And the key insight around this book is you can actively shape the working relationships you have to be the best possible versions of those relationships. BPRs, the best possible relationship. So it doesn't mean every relationship turns into this wonderful, you know, perfect thing. It means that when you're if you're A and you're working with B, there's potential between you. How do you fulfill as much of that potential as possible? How do you bring out the best of each other as much as you can? How do you avoid the worst of each other as much as you can?
Mm-hmm.
And the Keystone Conversation, and it's hard, is simply, let's have a conversation about how we work together before we plunge into the work. And again, simple and difficult, because most of us plunge into the work. You know, you sign up a new coaching client and you're like, right, I'm here to add value. So what are you up against? What's on your mind? What's the challenge? What's hard for you? How can I be serious? How will we measure success? And all of that's into the work. And you don't have a conversation around when you've had a coach, or you've thought about a coach and it's been a good working relationship, what do they do? And when you've had a mediocre coaching relationship, like in my time, I've had lots of coaches and a lot of them were like pretty underwhelming. And I can be really articulate about what I need in a coach if I'm hiring a coach and if they ask me. So it's this exchange of information about how do we bring out each other's best? How do we work together? How do we fix it when things go wrong? How do we get back on track? All of these kind of meta conversations that enable you to better do the work.
I call that right sizing.
Yeah.
Don't start doing the work until you know what you're doing.
Yeah. So part of it's right sizing, which is, what's the actual work, and that's why in the coaching habit, the question, what's the real challenge here for you, is so effective, because we all think the first thing that shows up is the real challenge, and it rarely is. It's just their first stab at it. You provide so much help if you can be the person to help figure out what the real problem is. You don't even need to come up with the answers. It's like just figuring out what the real problem is most of the magic. And then you're kind of, if bring that to the right sizing of the relationship as well, which is like, so what does the shape look like with you and me at our best?
And getting that out there is so important. But you trained with CTI just after I trained with Coach U.
Right.
And they talked about establishing the coaching agreement.
Yeah.
Which seems to have got lost in how much, how many, how often, and not what do we need to do the best that we can in this space right now.
Yeah. Well, how much, how many, how often is a useful and essential part of the conversation, but it's just not the whole part of the conversation. So, the origin of this work for me comes from a guy called Peter Block.
Yes.
And he called this stuff social contracting.
Ah.
And I social contracting is a bit abstract. It's a bit high level. It's used in other contexts in different ways, so it's a bit confusing. But essentially, it's the same, which is like, how do we work together? And what I like about a contract, this is the thing I like about that phrase, is a contract in legal terms is a exchange of value, an equal exchange of value. You do this thing for me, I give you money. It's an equal exchange of value. And this idea that we're not just figuring out the logistics, but we're actually exchanging the value of who we are and how we want to show up is what gives the relationship the opportunity to flourish. Because like, if you're a coach, and I know most people listening to this will be coaches or thinking about being coaches, learning how to coach is tricky, and you're training and you're mastering that. But then you have to run a practice. You have to find clients. You have to keep clients. And that's a whole other level of skill. And there aren't many coaches who are like, I love the marketing. I love trying to find new clients. Some people love that, but not that many. And one of the ways you can help yourself is by keeping your good clients longer. And one of the ways you can keep your good clients longer is you have a conversation about how will we keep this going as long as possible, so it's as good for both of us for as long as possible. And if you can pull that off, then you actually start building these long-term client relationships, which is good for the client and also good for your business.
Yeah, I'm not sure I agree with you on that one, but hey.
Oh, okay. So what do you want to take issue with?
So I it depends what the coaching's for, doesn't it? So if the coaching is an external thinking partner relationship over time, where somebody wants somebody to just travel with them, then that's a great thing. But I think often coaches are hired for a thing. And then that needs to be a shorter relationship. Otherwise, we just extend it for no reason.
Well, I agree with that. I mean, I think too often coaches' business models are kind of going, I'm trying to build codependence with this client.
Absolutely.
So it drags on forever and ever and ever. And there are too many coaching relationships where people on both sides are kind of slightly going through the motions of what that works. But, in the How to Work with Almost Anyone book, there are kind of three phases to kind of building this best possible relationship. The first is you taking time to answer the five core questions of the Keystone relationship yourself. So you know your answers, because it's in some ways a bit of a self-help book hidden inside a kind of so-called business book.
Right.
The second phase is you have the keystone conversation. You actually have a conversation around how you want to work together. But the third phase is the maintenance phase, which is like you need to check in often on how you check in all the time on how you're doing. You need to repair often and you need to reset as required. And what you and I are talking about is the reset process, which is like, all right, so are we done? Are we not done? If we're not done, what needs to be done to reset so we get back to this idea of a relationship? And these are the three columns of the three principles of a BPR, a best possible relationship, a relationship that is safe and vital and repairable. So safe meaning it's you removed fear, vital meaning that there's still life and challenge and provocation in there. And repair meaning you get to fix it when things go wrong, because it always goes wrong. And
exactly. Yeah.
I think what you and I are agreeing on is that too often coaching relationships become safe, but they lose some of their vitality because the kind of purpose of the relationship has kind of leaked out.
Yeah, and I love hearing you talk in a language that's different from mine, because it's enabling me to make a whole load of meaning of some of the things that I think. And I love
right.
that, because that relationship thing, that partnering thing, we're only in relationship and in partnership, aren't we, if we check in to make sure we still are, because otherwise I think
exactly.
we are and you think we're not.
Yeah, and quite frankly, the reason I stopped coaching is I just found myself too often in relationships that were a bit boring. I was like, I like you. I don't mind this coaching, but honestly, I'm a bit, it doesn't have a whole lot of vitality here for me. And I also figured out that I have more impact by doing different things. But I do think that we often default to safety and we forget about vitality.
Yeah. And the vitality brings the transformation, doesn't it? The energy and the bounce and the not doing the same thing all over again.
Yeah, I mean, I think you need both. I mean, you can if you had vitality and kind of provocation, if you like, without safety, then it's really good until it isn't, and then it shatters. So you're trying to find that dance between safe and vital, and it's different with every client you have. And then for all of them, there comes this time where it's something gets misunderstood, something goes off the rails, something leaks, something breaks, something rips. And that's the repairability. Because if you can repair it, you have a chance of extending it for the full length and the full potential of the relationship.
That's so insightful, because there's a sort of hidden implicit assumption that things won't break, isn't there?
Yeah,
they will.
Like we all start going, oh, it's amazing. I've hired a coach. Oh, it's amazing. I've got a new client. Oh, we love each other. But, you know, to be blunt, shit always hits some fan somewhere down the line. There's no such thing as a relationship without kind of hiccups in it. And often, it's a sweeping generalization. But, you know, because coaching is full of nice people who are people and trying to do their best, they're often not that good at conflict. They're not that good at repair. They're like, let's just keep it nice. And nice can suck the life out of a good relationship.
I wish we'd had this conversation before I did a supervision session on Monday. You know, this, it's so jargony, this thing that people say to me, how do I use myself as instrument? And I go, no, let's talk about saying what you notice or sense or experience.
Right.
But this coach came to supervision, and the question was, she and the person she was coaching had a disagreement. And she said, how do we use the disagreement for learning? And I said, it depends on how much you've annoyed them. You know, is this about the disagreement is part of the learning, or is it that the disagreement is just that something you have done has been experienced by them as being really irritating?
Right.
Because it's not the same thing.
No, I mean, I think that I would go, look, first of all, how do you use this disagreement to repair the relationship and possibly re-strengthen it? And then how do you learn from that experience so that when it shows up again between the two of you, you're better able to navigate it the second time.
Yeah. And it may be showing you something about what's going on in their working life, but it may actually be showing something about how you're getting on with each other.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, because we were talking about patronizing. You can be really patronizing by accident in those contexts, can't you?
That's true. It is. I think it's a real danger with coaching is there's a slight odor of moral superiority sometimes with coaches, which is like, you know, look how advanced I am and how self-aware I am and how open-hearted and open-minded and stuff I am. And all of that is great stuff when you're doing the work and kind of becoming that. But I remember, I mean, this is like 15 years ago or longer, perhaps, going to a at the time the ICF held these big international conferences, and just wandering around, going, we all feel very smug here, like we're all very self congratulatory about how the sun shines out of various orifices, and one of the attributes I most like is humility. Not in a kind of false, look at me, I'm so humble. Humility for me means you have your feet on the ground. There's actually a connection between humility and the word for ground, humus.
Yes.
Humility for me is knowing both your strengths and your non-strengths and kind of holding them in balance. Like, I think I'm, this will sound weird that I'm saying this so assertively, but I think I'm quite humble. I'm confident and humble in that I'm confident about who I am and how I show up in the world and where I think I can best serve. And I'm really clear about all the stuff I'm a bit shit at, and there's plenty of it.
Yeah. And we're all a bit broken.
Yeah.
I share that. I often say to friends and colleagues, I can't stand being with coaches because it all feels a bit worthy.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think, when it feels in a conversation that somebody who's sorted is working with somebody who's not as sorted, the power differential there is massive, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, that's right. And it's a metaphor that gets talked about a bit, but the kintsugi metaphor, which is like, porcelain repaired with gold lacquer, and it's like broken but fixed and more beautiful and different. A similar but different metaphor is that scar tissue is the strongest tissue in the human body, which actually isn't true, unfortunately, but it would be great if it was. But, it's like it's our scars and our wounds and our stories of failure that make us more interesting and more useful to the people with whom we're trying to help.
And yet there's a fear to disclose that we're not superhuman.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if you listen to this and you're worrying, I'm like, if it's any use, it's a whole lot easier to go, look, I'm probably more screwed up than you are, and I still can ask a good question or two. So yeah, it's a very freeing experience to go, yeah, I'm a bit of a mess.
Well, and I said to a group the other day, when I did when I did a coaching session a few weeks ago, which was the worst I've done for a very long time, and they all went. And I went, well, if you're going to do your best work, you're going to do your worst work, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. That's nice.
There's a chapter about humility in the new book, The Human Behind the Coach. And
that's great.
Because we're just trying to get people to recognize that actually this isn't about being perfect or superhuman or special or different.
Yeah.
That we're one human who facilitates the thinking of another.
Yeah. It's the more you can be nuanced in your humanity, the more helpful, just kind of the more real you are to the world.
Which is why, coming back to the advice trap, when I say to people what you say about the advice monster, they go, oh, thank goodness.
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
it's named, it's normal.
Often the feedback I've had, and I think this is true, is that some of the what's most useful in my work is I thingify more abstract concepts. So, the advice monster, and there's kind of three of them, if you like, save it, tell it, and control it. They're kind of like a simpler way of understanding some of the kind of deeper ego-driven reasons why we might leap to give advice to protect ourselves, and protect our status and protect our kind of sense of who we are. But when you call it an advice monster and you go, you probably noticed your advice monster. Everyone's like, yeah, I have an advice monster. I'm like, we all have an advice monster. You're in very good company. You're a whole of humanity.
Yeah. Yeah. So what's your hope for your work? What do you want it to have done, to do in the future?
Well, for years now, I've had a personal mission, and my language is to infect 1 billion people with the possibility virus.
Oh, wow.
That was better language before COVID and we had a virus.
Yeah.
But if you want to kind of unpack that, you know, 1 billion people is an impossibly large number, but it speaks to kind of me thinking about scale of impact. The virus idea is that it can spread without me. So it's about putting ideas into the world, and I don't need to be known for them. I don't need to be the hero. I don't need to be the guru. You know, if people discover the 7 questions from the coaching habit and they don't know them from me, that's fine by me. And then the possibility virus, what that means is to help people make braver choices. It comes down to kind of man's search for meaning, which is like, you know, in the moment we have a choice. It's helping people see that they have choices and help them make the braver choice, so that they get to kind of unlock the best of who they are, unlock their own greatness. So, you know, that's the kind of the ripple effect that I'm trying to have in the work that I do. And I also don't think too much about it. Because you know, my job is to take my best guess at the next project that is my best contribution to that bigger game, and then put it out in the world. And you know, some things spread and some things don't spread as much. And you know, as an atheist, I'm pretty sure that once I'm dead, I'm dead. So I don't get my reward in heaven or anything like that. So it's already working better than I thought it would with the success of some of these coaching books. And so I keep doing that work, and it's lovely to hear back from people occasionally when it's been helpful from them.
Well, it's very helpful. Lots of our listeners have been infected.
Well, thank you.
And
I love about that is that, you know, and then they coach differently and they touch other people. And so there's this kind of ripple effect, and you know, 1 or 2 or 3 degrees that can make a difference.
Yeah. And I'm taking the advice monster and your name into a group of 500 on Tuesday. So
fantastic. Thank you so much.
Michael, thank you so much for coming to the Coaching Inn. What a pleasure it's been to be in conversation with you.
Thank you, Claire. It's been wonderful.
And hopefully maybe you, me and Catherine Munnitz can have a glass of wine one day.
That would be fun. Exactly.
And thank you everyone for listening. Bye-bye.
If you've enjoyed what you've heard today, we'd love you to share the podcast with a friend or leave a comment on social media. And if you'd like to become a regular at the Coaching Inn, you can subscribe on Podbean and all major podcast channels. We look forward to welcoming you next time. You've been listening to The Coaching Inn, 3D Coaching's virtual pub. For more information, check out 3dcoaching.com.